Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, January 13, 2014. We have important breaking news. Some national coverage of the incarceration of Roger Shuler, our colleague and the blogger who is unlawfully detained almost 75 days now in Shelby County, Alabama. We'll get to that story in just a moment. But first, I always like to start the show with a little music. And over the weekend, I got a fresh collection of politically infused rock and roll from a Los Angeles band called John Dist. And its frontman, John Dist. The CD is called Red Flag. And this is a tune about Guantanamo and illegal indefinite incarceration. It's called Black Site.
Got no evidence, my lawyer was told. If he knew what's good for him, turn around and go home. If pressed no charges, it's the luck of the draw. Wrong place, the wrong time, there's gotta be a law.
And John just penned a little note when he sent the CD. He said he found out about us from the Boiling Frogs podcast at boilingfrogspost.com and that it has informed some of the political messages in his music. Thank you for that, John, and I'm happy to return the favor and share your tunes with my worldwide podcast audience. Now to the important lead story. The New York Times, in its Sunday edition, gave prominent coverage to the case of Roger Shuler, a longtime contributor to this program, the proprietor of the Legal Schnauzer blog. And while national coverage is always a good thing, and the story does, in many cases, accurately reflect what has happened to Roger Shuler, I have to say that it is spun up in a way that makes him seem like a nut. And I do understand that perception, particularly if you're a journalist from New York, and you're not aware of the history of the swamp that is the so-called criminal justice system in the state of Alabama, of the longtime corruption of both the state and federal courts in Bama. And it's interesting because Campbell Robertson, a reporter I'm not familiar with, from what I know, spent a couple of hours on the phone with Carol Shuler, Roger's wife, and she clearly followed up on some of the critics of Roger Shuler. And I will concede, and by the way, I don't know if Campbell is a male or a female, so excuse that article that I just used, Mr. or Ms. Robertson. In any case, the reporter did note, and it's newsworthy and it's novel, that many of the people who feel they've been burned by the reporting of Roger Shuler in the past nevertheless believe that he is unlawfully incarcerated in Alabama today. And that is worth noting. Also in the second paragraph of this story, the reporter notes that Shuler has been put on a list of imprisoned journalists kept by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Quote, there in the company of jailed reporters in China, Iran, and Egypt is Mr. Shuler, the only person on the list in the entire Western Hemisphere. Then it gives a little of the history of Roger Shuler, and instead of focusing on the work that he has done regarding the Don Siegelman case, which gets zero mention in this lengthy New York Times article, they focus on some of the local squabbles that Roger and Carol have gotten into. And it's fair to say that Roger Shuler has litigated in court on many occasions to pursue things that he felt were wrong, and he has not prevailed. But without noting how corrupt the justice system is in Alabama, well, just in looking at it from a cold, detached way, you'd say, well, he's a loser. But context is so important here. And by leaving out the Siegelman case, the reporter ignored what is the origins of the beef between Roger Shuler and Bob Riley, the governor who displaced Don Siegelman, and his boy Rob Riley Jr., who is hoping to take over a seat in Congress. And their long-running feud with the Siegelmans and the great coverage that Roger Shuler provided of the Siegelman case are very important background for, and again, this reporter failed to note that it was Justice Roy Moore, the Ten Commandments guy, who handpicked retired Judge Claude Nielsen to hear this case. Almost a private judge for the Riley family is the way it plays out to me. None of that got mentioned in this article. And it's clear that the reporter didn't look deeply at the history of Roger Shuler's blog, because it's cited here, his allegations are frequently salacious, including a recent assertion that a federal judge had appeared in a gay porno magazine and a theory that several suicides were actually a string of politically motivated murders. Starting in January of 13, Shuler, citing unidentified sources, began writing that Riley Jr. had impregnated a lobbyist named Liberty Duke and secretly paid for an abortion. Both denied it, and Ms. Duke swore in an affidavit that they had never even been alone in the same room. So that passes for a summary of more than 7 years of work that Roger Shuler has done at Legal Schnauzer. And, of course, the central feature of his reporting, from my point of view, has been on the Siegelman case and its many ramifications. And, in fact, my perception is that Roger Shuler got onto the sexual antics of Attorney General Luther Strange, the porno picture of federal court judge Bill Pryor, and the extramarital affair alleged of Rob Riley and Liberty Duke. He found out about those because he originally uncovered the dirt on Mark Fuller, the judge who presided over the Siegelman case, a federal judge, who at the same time he was presiding over the Siegelman and Scrushy cases, owned almost a majority interest in a company that had a sweetheart $300 million contract with the Pentagon. And Mark Fuller, it's disclosed in his own divorce papers, at that time was having an affair with his court clerk. And so this context is very important because it makes it seem like Roger Shuler is some sort of a voyeur who gets some weird thrill out of exposing sexual behavior by others. His central attack is on hypocrisy. And a lot of people miss that point, including the New York Times reporter. Now, in the account of Roger Shuler's arrest on October 23rd, the New York Times omits that there was no warrant either presented or referred to by the deputy who trespassed on the Shuler's property, went into the garage, maced Roger Shuler, tackled him, brutalized him, injured him, and then charged him with resisting arrest. And by the way, the hearing on the resisting charge is going to be held on January 14th, that is Tuesday, tomorrow, at the courthouse in Shelby County. And so the one bit of news that the New York Times reported that had not been clear to me was that it says here, on November 14, the judge held a hearing, and Mr. Shuler, who was representing himself, took the stand, insisting that the court had no jurisdiction over him and calling the court a joke. Well, those are fair comments, and I share Roger's view of that. Saying that to the court, when you don't have a lawyer, you're representing yourself, you're already being held indefinitely in jail, may not be the wisest thing to say. And the Times goes on, the judge decided that the hearing had, quote, served as a trial on the merits, end quote, and made his final ruling. Shuler was forbidden to publish anything about Riley or Duke involving an affair, an abortion, or payoffs, was to pay them nearly $34,000 for legal fees, and was to remove the offending posts or remain in jail. Now, I am surprised, because this is a huge miscarriage of justice, to use the hearing where Roger didn't have a lawyer and had no ability to prepare a case, and then to claim that that was a substitute for a trial on the merits in the defamation claim? That is justice beneath the level of a kangaroo court. Now, here's the capper. Directly from that narrative in the New York Times article, they then go to the guy who is bringing these charges against Schuller, Rob Riley. And they quote him. Hardly an unbiased or, you know, arm's length participant in these proceedings. Mr. Riley said Mr. Schuller's refusal to engage with the legal process had given the judge the leeway to make a final ruling. Quote, if someone can continually ignore the judge just by saying you don't have jurisdiction over me, then the whole system breaks down, Mr. Riley said, adding that Mr. Schuller could not plead ignorance of the legal process. This is not the first time Roger Schuller has been in court. Wow. What bullshit. I mean, first of all, it's way out of line for the Times to quote a plaintiff in this case, maybe his lawyer. But here's the guy who says he's a victim of Roger Schuller's reporting. And he's allowed to argue that this monkey business process of Judge Nielsen is justifiable because Roger Schuller ignored them saying you don't have jurisdiction over me. The way you deal with that is you file a court case and establish whether the jurisdiction is there. You hold a hearing. That's what our system is designed to do. And the Schullers are very angry at one of the final statements in this article. It says, so while the furor has all but dissipated, Schuller remains in jail, unwilling to take down his posts, but also unwilling to hire a lawyer and contest his incarceration in the state courts. Then they lift a quote from him from the interview at Who, What, Why a couple of months ago. Quoting Schuller, this is flat-out corruption and it's criminal. The Schullers have been looking very hard for a lawyer. And I know because I've been trying to help them. It has not been easy. And I can't explain why the ACLU of Alabama was only willing to file a legal brief and not willing to represent Roger Schuller. And we've approached many of the First Amendment groups, and we get polite reception. But there's nobody booking a plane ticket to Montgomery, Alabama, to file briefs for Roger Schuller in the near future. I also want to add that over at Salon.com, Natasha Leonard recapped the Times article in a post that included what I thought was a really unfair swipe at Roger Schuller. And I'm not going to repeat it because I thought it was unfair. And I'm not going to repeat it because, to her credit, after exchanging a couple of emails with me, Natasha Leonard agreed to take it down. I appreciate that. It's rare when a journalist listens and says, okay, you know, maybe that was a little too much. So, Natasha Leonard, you earn a gold star from the Peter B. Collins Show today. Now on to other stories. In Washington, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that is inside baseball, but very important. It has to do with appointments by the president to jobs that require Senate confirmation. And when the Senate refuses to schedule a confirmation, they don't reject the nominee. They simply stretch out the process, hoping that person will go away. The presidents of both parties over the years, when they encounter a Senate that won't confirm an appointee, have either withdrawn the nomination or, when the Senate is in recess, the Constitution permits the president to make appointments that are only good until the end of the next session, up to 2 years. And so this was used, like I said, by every president in the past, members of each party. But since Obama has attempted it, Republicans have challenged it, and there are several nominations that now hang by a thread because the Supreme Court, in its oral arguments, indicated that it's not sympathetic to the president's position. Now, most of this really revolves around a definition of what is a recess. And I don't want to sound like Bill Clinton. What is the meaning of is? Is? But the Republicans, who were running the Senate at the time, would send a senator who lived near Washington over to the chambers to pretend to preside over a session. They'd do that every 3 days. And even though every other senator was out of town and there was no business being conducted, they would pretend that this is not a recess because there's a Republican senator there and we have not declared the Senate to be in official recess. It's a game. A stupid game. But nominees to the National Labor Relations Board who were appointed in recess appointments may find that their appointments are invalid, and then their votes since the time they were appointed would be described as invalid. And that could throw a real monkey wrench into appointments made by this administration. I want to thank the people who support the Peter B. Collins podcast with your subscriptions. And here in January, it seems that a lot of people who have annual subscriptions come up for renewal. And so I want to thank Joan Fauber. She just renewed for another year. Deborah Newell, she's back in for 2014. Susan Fellows and Derek McElhinney. I want to thank each and every one of you. And by the way, if you think your subscription is about to come up for renewal and for whatever reason you want to cancel, get out in front of it, because my robots, unfortunately, are not programmed to send you a reminder notice that your subscription is about to expire. And some people are a little surprised when it automatically renews. And if that happens, just send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. And if you want a refund or you want to cancel, it is your wish is my command. We'll take care of it right away. But I do encourage you to renew and continue to support our program because it's very important to me. And if you take out a new annual subscription right now, all you got to do is go to peterbcollins.com and follow the sign-up link right under my picture on the homepage. We've got a bonus bag of Kona, that's kick-ass Kona coffee beans, to send you. There's a box on the way from the Big Island right now, and as soon as I get it, I'm going to be divvying it up and sending it out to new subscribers. You could be among them. So sign up today, and the bonus bag of coffee will be on its way to you. I also have some bonus books that I will send to new annual subscribers. And here's the other way you can support our program and kick in $15 of somebody else's money. It's easy. Just follow the banner ad or the links in the the podcast show file for this particular podcast over to audible.com. When you sign up for a free 30-day trial subscription, you get an audiobook download absolutely free, and you can choose from over 150,000 titles. Now, you can stay with them if you want and keep that subscription going, or you can cancel within 30 days and it won't cost you a penny. In either case, Audible will pay me $15 just because you tried their service. It's a no-risk, no-cost way that you can kick in $15 to support the podcast. Lots of people are doing it, and I hope you will join them. The Supreme Court today also made a very important decision by doing nothing. It declined to hear an appeal from Arizona seeking to revive a state law that bars most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. Now, this is a very important signal from the court that it is not inclined to overturn Roe versus Wade anytime soon, and that the state-level laws that nip away at abortion access and abortion rights, if they're found unconstitutional at the appeals court level, will not be heard by the Supreme Court. Now, the Catholics and the right-wingers on the court may be holding out for a case where they think they can kill Roe versus Wade. They may just be buying time. Because when they turn away an appeal like this, all that happens is the appeals court decision stands, but it doesn't necessarily set a precedent at the Supreme Court level. So, as I say, this is just one of many attempts to roll back women's abortion rights and access to abortion without, you know, actually outlawing the entire right to choice. And I give credit to the New York Times, which on Sunday, January 12th, ran a lengthy article and showed how it's mostly Republicans, but there is a lot of political activity at the state level by Republicans and some Democratic groups. And it lays out some of the battleground issues of voter ID, unions, same-sex marriage, minimum wage, Medicaid, and abortion rights. And in a very clear chart here, it shows that 22 states, all but six controlled by Republicans, enacted 70 abortion restrictions last year. The laws range from bans on abortions 20 weeks after fertilization, like the one we just talked about from Arizona, to limitations on insurance coverage of abortions. And of those 70 bills, only one of them occurred in a blue state, the state of Maryland. And I don't know explicitly what that abortion-related bill was. But there are a few of the purple states, Virginia and Missouri. But the red states that have restricted a woman's right to choose, and by the way, by blowing up Planned Parenthood contracts, they've also seen a new rush of sexually transmitted diseases. The stats are in for last year, and it is alarming. But here are the red states. They're rolling back abortion rights. Texas, Indiana, Wisconsin, Alabama, South Carolina, Louisiana, Ohio, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and there are a few other red dots that don't have a state next to them. And this is one of the things that I have been talking about since 2010, because nationally, the Democrats were so ecstatic over Obama winning the White House in 2008 and maintaining control of the House in 2008 that I believe they ignored the challenges at the state house level. We have 23 states that are solid red, Republican governor and both legislatures solidly controlled by the GOP. And that's where the most damage is being done right now. And because of redistricting, it also locks in likely control of the House of Representatives at least through 2020 because of gerrymandering. And all these factors were easy for us to see. You know, it's not like redistricting is a secret that just pops up. And yet the Democrats have been left flat-footed. Well, on Friday, I misspoke. And I'm going to apologize even before I tell you what I said. I regret that I said I wasn't going to talk about Chris Christie anymore because I thought the Bridgegate scandal was over. And I will continue to maintain that the corporate media, and in particular MSNBC, went way too far in wall-to-wall coverage of the Chris Christie scandal. And while Rachel Maddow ignored everything else, we had 300,000 people who couldn't drink their water or take a bath in West Virginia. The Senate introduced the Trans-Pacific Partnership fast-track legislation while most people weren't looking. And as we reported here, a group of NSA whistleblowers, including Bill Binney, Tom Drake, and others, issued two important memos, one offering to share their knowledge with President Obama, the other listing a 20-plus point agenda for real reform of the NSA. And those issues didn't get covered because Rachel Maddow and her colleagues were so determined to take down Chris Christie. And as I mentioned, he's doing a pretty good job on his own. And now we're learning that there is the sniff of real scandal because Congressman Frank Pallone, Democrat from New Jersey, has announced that there will be an audit and an investigation into the spending of Hurricane Sandy relief money. And in particular, money that was in a $25 million budget set aside for a media campaign. And about $4.5 million of that was used for television commercials saying, come on back to the Jersey Shore. And those commercials featured not only Chris Christie, but his wife and children. And these commercials ran during his campaign for re-election as governor, or right before it. So that in and of itself is stinky and inappropriate. But it turns out that the PR firm that got the contract overbid its other competitor by more than $2 million. And the only substantial difference in their proposals was that the winning bid, sustained by the MWW Group, promised to feature Chris Christie and his family in the TV commercials that were run using federal tax dollars. And so this is the part of the scandal that could have real legs and skinnier legs than Chris Christie's. And this was surprising. In Saturday's New York Times, it's kind of a Mad Libs of political apologies. And what they did is they took a line from each apology speech of a famous disgraced politician. And I'll read a few of these for you. It's a little lengthy, but you'll get the flavor. So first, a quote from Senator John Ensign of Nevada, 2011. I rise today to deliver a very difficult speech. Next line from disgraced Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, now back in the U.S. Congress. I'll lay it out. It's going to hurt, and we'll let the chips fall where they may. Next line from disgraced former CIA director and superstar general David Petraeus. I join you, keenly aware that I am regarded in a different light now than I was a year ago. Next up, Randy Duke Cunningham, the corrupt congressman from San Diego. Quote, in recent weeks, serious questions have been raised about my conduct in office. I welcome any and all appropriate investigations. Well, he didn't mean that because he ended up doing 5 or 6 years in federal prison. Then the Nixon Checkers speech of 52. I want the American people to know all the facts, and I am not afraid of having independent people go in and check the facts. All right, next up, James McGreevy of New Jersey, the last governor there to get in a hot pickle. He was exposed as having an affair with a gay man. At a point in every person's life, one has to look deeply into the mirror of one's soul and decide one's unique truth in the world, not as we may want to see or hope to see it, but as it is. And I can't resist one more line from Anthony Weiner of New York last summer. While some of the things that have been posted today are true and some are not, there's no question that what I did was wrong. The behavior that I did was problematic, to say the least, destructive, to say the most. In other news, Ariel Sharon is finally dead. And I'm conflicted because I don't like to speak ill of the recently departed. But to be fair, Ariel Sharon has been in a coma since 2006. And he was declared dead after 8 years on Saturday, January 11th. And I don't mourn his passing. He was one of the most virulent Zionists to head Israel and set the tone, depicting the Palestinians as the obstacle to peace. And that is a theme that is still alive and well even today, as Israel continues to expand settlements and blame the Palestinians for resisting that. And the Palestinians called Sharon the butcher of Sabra and Shatila. And he had a very violent past as a Zionist terrorist. There are many people who think that you can't put those two words together ever. But I do, and I have no regrets. As I mentioned, the Palestinians are being blamed because Israel, just after John Kerry stepped on the plane after a little shuttle diplomacy, announced that they plan to build 1,400 housing units in Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. This is the frequent poke in the eye that Israel gives to visiting Americans and whenever there's any hint of progress in peace talks with the Palestinians. And it's really shameful, shameful behavior. And I'm pleased to see that another American academic group has approved a resolution critical of Israel. The Modern Language Association, which has 28,000 academics who belong, narrowly approved a resolution. And it doesn't go quite as far as the resolution by the ASA, which is the American Studies Association, we talked to one of its members about their boycott of Israel a few weeks back. It was in the same interview when we released the powerful conversation with Max Blumenthal about his book called Goliath. So this resolution doesn't call for a boycott, and the group also voted against a resolution introduced by its radical caucus, I'm glad they have one, to condemn the attacks on the ASA. But it is an important, if cautious, statement of opposition to the criminal behavior of the State of Israel. And just across the Sinai Peninsula, it looks like General Abdul Fattah el-Sisi, who led the coup that the U.S. doesn't call a coup last July 3rd that ousted Mohamed Morsi, the first freely elected president of Egypt. Well, General al-Sisi has announced unofficially that Mubarak 2.0 will take effect because he is dangling the offer to run for president. He's waiting for people to say, please, 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 General al-Sisi, we need you, we need you. And so he is opening the door to that opportunity. And we have yet to hear any sharp criticism from the United States of the crackdown on Islamists and members of the Muslim Brotherhood. They have a new constitution in Egypt that is supposed to protect religious rights. But clearly, Muslims are being singled out, and they are attempting to eradicate the Muslim Brotherhood, and I just predict that this will be a replay of what happened under Mubarak. More detention, more torture, and a long-time struggle with many lives lost. When we think about what's going on in Washington and how the Obama administration is trying to do as little as possible to reform the NSA, we have to ask, where is our cyber defense? Where are the cyber warriors? When it comes to now 80 or 100 million records stolen from Target. And on top of that, we've learned that Neiman Marcus has had a large security breach and that thieves have stolen customers' payment card information and made unauthorized charges. David Lazarus, who writes a consumer column for the Los Angeles Times, is one of the victims of the Target security breach. And he wrote an article about it on Friday and then updated it on Saturday to say that hours after he posted his most recent story, his American Express card was used fraudulently by an unknown person to charge luxury goods. I think it was even at Prada. So this is a major scandal. This is a big breach. And the president could win a lot of goodwill by saying, you know, we're going to stop spying on Americans and look for the criminals who hacked into Target and Neiman Marcus and other places where they have compromised the privacy and the security of credit card operations. Oh, there I go daydream again. I'm really sorry. And before I leave you today, I just want to acknowledge that it was 50 years ago last week that a Surgeon General's report on smoking and tobacco started the process, a 50-year campaign to rein in tobacco use. And I want to single out a couple of people who have been instrumental in this process. Millions of lives have been saved. And there's just no question that the heroic efforts of individuals all across the country, but the key players who I know who helped really make a sea change in attitudes toward tobacco smoking are Dr. Stanton H. Glantz, a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, and a tireless opponent of the tobacco lobby. Also, Mark Perchuk and Julia Carroll, who were the co-directors of a group called Americans for Nonsmokers' Rights. I met them in the late 80s or about 1990, And I only learned recently that their group, which helped pass many of the laws, that we were told, oh, we can't restrict smoking in restaurants. People won't go to those restaurants. We can't limit smoking or ban it in bars. People will stop buying booze. Well, none of those alleged risks turned out to be true. And what I found out recently was Americans for Nonsmokers' Rights was largely funded by Jane Fonda. By the massive amount of money she made from those Jane Fonda workout videotapes in the 1980s. You remember those? So, let me add Jane Fonda to that list. And I celebrate. Empty, clean ashtrays. And airliners that are smoke-free. 50 years after that important Surgeon General's report. Thanks for joining me today. This is the podcast you're authorized to share with anyone.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.